Welcome to Boxes and Lines, a different kind of finance podcast from a different kind of stock exchange, featuring IEX founder Ronan Ryan and Chief Market Policy Officer John Ramsey. Now here to give you the straight talk on how the markets really work, it's Ronan and JR.
Welcome everybody to the latest episode of Boxes and Lines.
Welcome to Larry Tabb. Welcome to Boxes and Lines.
Once again, he jumped the gun. Yes, our guest of the day is Larry Tabb, Director of Market Structure Research at Bloomberg Intelligence. All of us know Larry, but...
A man who needs really no introduction.
I know, but I got to anyway, because believe it or not, Larry, you're going to learn that there's people who listen to this podcast that are not in our industry. So we know him, but people don't. Larry was research chairman at Tabb Group, published on several aspects of capital markets industry, market structure, U.S. and European market structure, central clearing, credit default swaps, fixed income, equity, and foreign exchange. And he's a model American.
And Ronan did all that from memory, which I find it extraordinary.
I just blacked out there. Prior to that, Larry was vice president and founder of Tower Group Securities Investment Practices. Welcome to the podcast, Larry.
Thanks, Ronan.
He didn't run out the door.
No.
He's staying.
No, he's still here.
I'm tired.
Okay. So the podcast is timely because you're in the midst of releasing your U.S. equity study. We saw some of it on the Bloomberg terminal. I subscribe to a terminal. John doesn't.
Oh, he doesn't let me.
He gets very upset that I have the cool keyboard and screen. Mm-hmm. One day, John, one day.
Yeah.
If we can monetize this podcast, like Bloomberg could put commercials on here and paper. Right. Anyway, sorry. Yeah. We got to let the guest speak. So you just released in the U.S. equity study. Can you tell us about that? How long have you been doing it? What's it encompass? Everything.
Sure. The U.S. equity study really is around from when I started Tab Group. In fact, that was really the first major thing we did, kind of put us on the map. We've been interviewing buy-side U.S. equity traders really for almost 20 years now.
So it's just buy-side you interview?
It's just
you ask them questions about the sell side and that type of stuff?
Well, we ask them all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
We started off really talking a long time about algorithms and how they allocate their order flow, and it's turned into allocations, what rates are they paying, who do they do business, why do they do business, what are the things that they want from their brokers. We talked a little bit about AI this year, what their thoughts on that were. We've been talking about crypto for a couple of years, who they think is going to win, lose in terms of, who's going to gain share, who's going to lose share. And then a couple of years ago, we expanded it to Europe. And now we're talking to, some of it's online survey stuff. And we try to talk with folks for, I don't know, a half hour or 45 minutes. Oh. About various topics as well, and
how
try
many
to put all that stuff.
How
together.
Many buy side do you chat with?
This year was 110.
Oh, so it's a good subset.
So it's a good and it's a good mix of large, medium, and small. And we try to segment out, what the large guys are doing versus the medium and the small. And we'll break it out by hedge funds and long onlys, and we'll break it out by fundamentals and quants, and try to get a good understanding of what the hell is going on.
And then based on that, do you put together a whole study? I saw the broker ranking.
So
are there
what
other
we've
things?
Done, well, at Tab, we used to publish the whole thing at once.
Yeah.
Our publishing format is actually kind of wild. It's basically 650 characters in a chart. And that's my writing format.
That's,
so everything has
that's
to,
the limitation?
Yeah. So everything has to be in these what they call bits of 650 characters. It's like writing research on Twitter.
Is and that then, due to the terminal or something?
Yeah, I think because it's meant to be an online thing.
Yeah.
And so that's the format. And it actually, that was one of the challenges at Tab is that people didn't really want to read long reports anymore. They wanted to read snippets. But when you went around trying to collect money for research, it's like they didn't want to pay for three pages with lots of data. They wanted to pay for things that were sizable. And we wound up in this weird.
That's a dilemma, isn't it?
Yeah.
They don't want the 30-page report,
but they don't want to
pay it for a small one.
And they don't want to read the larger report either. So the Bloomberg format's actually pretty nice. And that's it. Now we're going the reverse direction. And for the first time, we're starting to do long form reports. So we're gathering up all these things and we'll put out this 100-page report with 150 charts. And that'll probably come out in a couple of months once we do that. But we started publishing before Christmas and we'll finish in a week or so.
Oh, okay.
So there's a lot of content.
Anything in there that was really surprising that caught you off guard? Like maybe crypto is less chatted about than it was 2 years ago? But
Crypto has never had a ton of traction with the buy side traders. They're fiduciaries, most of them. And they're thinking, okay, how do I value this thing? And, how do I value it compared to Apple or IBM or whatever? And it's really hard to do. So they don't have a whole lot of high regard for crypto, even though a lot of them think it's going to wind up being something in the future. But, you know, it's not really
a product. And now you have Bitcoin ETFs, but, you know, sort of so what? Maybe that means that there's slightly more adoption by some for institutional investors, but it's not going to be like a huge part of anybody's portfolio, you would think.
Unless there's, like, at least the ones we talk to, and I don't know if this is the same as you, they're waiting for real regulation. And
I think they are.
Yeah.
You know, and even with that, I'm not sure that, you know, because the issue is if you think about equities or bonds, everything's built on evaluation. Bonds is all about cash flows. Equities is about future returns, you know, the present value of future returns. You know, with Ethereum, when they started doing staking and you can kind of invest in it, there's kind of a return. But given what's going on with some of the crypto platforms, it's like everybody's kind of like shunning this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of made it easier for them to stay away from it. But I got interesting feedback recently that I hadn't thought of but should have thought of. And they said, even if it gets regulated and even if brokers connect to it and they can even trade it via fix like they would a standard equity order, they still, in order to invest in it, have to have investment teams with valuation conviction and reasons.
Right.
Like, you can't just take 10% of the use of proceeds and you just start slinging it around in crypto because it seems cool.
Yeah, when you talk with traders, they want to be clued in. They want to get, you know, high-touch service. They want to get research from the brokers. But they can't just say, if all of a sudden, Ronan, you call me and say, hey, Larry, I got this hot name you should invest in. In most funds, they can't just say, okay, Ronan, here's some money. Go, you know, I'm going to go do this.
Do you have any of those
hot
tips for us right now, Larry?
I stay.
we're all listening.
We won't tell anybody.
We'll block it out. We'll take that out of the podcast.
We'll bleep whatever you say, people will be dying to know.
I think IEX. There you go.
Good answer.
Exactly.
You can stay. Anything else surprising in the study?
What else is surprising? There is still a huge demand for high-touch services. That's always up there. ESG side, a lot of these funds have ESG products, but they're not really determining who they trade with by, you know, from ESG.
Yeah.
The market structure stuff is actually very interesting. You know, they're not very happy with the SEC. Even the buy side is just not happy with the way the direction the SEC has taken over the last couple of years, just basically throwing everything against the wall. And even to a certain extent, I think they'd like to see half-cent spreads for tick and strain names, but anything more than that, I just don't think they want to see.
Well, from our research, it seems that they also would like access fees reduced substantially, right?
Absolutely.
So those two things.
They would love to see 10 to 15 mil access fees.
But on tick increments, Larry's right, because we had talked to a lot of the buy side, and I really don't think anybody had any conviction on anything less than half a penny, and only on those names that are tick and strain. Now, There's lots of arguments as to what that is.
Yeah. If you're trying to do, you know, 100,000 shares of a stock, you know, and you wind up cutting the tick increment to a tenth of a cent, your average trade size is going to be 10 shares.
Yep.
Well, right. So there were a lot of criticism, right? Well, this is a useful pivot, maybe, to talk about the market structure reforms.
Look how brave we are with the regulators. Like 10 years ago, I don't know how, like even the buy side are saying negative things about the SEC. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, but.
Oh, John used to work there, so this is where the.
I think you're even seeing the buy side saying they could possibly sue on some of the stuff, which you never saw.
Yeah, that would be nuts.
Yes, but I think probably not on the market structure stuff. So what I wanted to sort of focus on is, I think there are a lot of folks that have focused on kind of the breadth and scope of the number of different proposals.
Yes, absolutely.
But that should not obscure the fact that there are some significant changes that the SEC could do to update the rules around Reg NMS. And you mentioned reducing tick size, reducing access fees that people have been talking, as you know, have been talking about for a very long time. And those would be meaningful changes if they were put into place.
I think the buy side is, the majority of them are up for change. They are just not up for the massive amount in what the SEC has proposed. I think there's absolutely a pony in there that the SEC could get through with probably, I wouldn't say unanimous consent, but pretty significant consent.
Yeah. Because it seems, and Larry, you're as smart of an observer of market structure as anybody, but as you well know, an awful lot has changed since 2005. I mean, the markets, when the Reg NMS was adopted, there's huge, it would almost be irresponsible for the SEC not to try to update those rules.
Absolutely. The pony is half cent on tick and strain, 10 to 15 mil access fees. I even think they would go to a tenth on internalization increments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We support all of those.
Yeah. I think that The auction thing is a non-starter, but I think everybody would love to see some better work on retail liquidity programs or the retail programs and try to figure out how to get more of that flow interact with more of that flow, either in exchanges or ATSs.
Well, let others compete. So it's interesting. We just came back. Well, I just came back from Miami. Thank you for ELS Equity Leaders Summit.
And Brendan wouldn't let me go to that. he thought that.
I need someone to run the ship here, and there's no better man than you.
I think I'd be a significant draw. I don't know that you really.
Well, like, you weren't on the panel.
Do you think they'd significantly draw on you?
It depends what he says on the panel, but it was similar to that in that people think like the auction, that form of competition forced on everybody, is a little bit too aggressive. But people, and particularly buy side, were on panel saying, however you want to call it, there is inaccessible liquidity, call it uninformed flow. They want to interact with that as well and would be happy to do so. I think Stockland from BMO had sort of said like the price increments of 10 mils, of 10 mils could be a way exchanges and ATSs could potentially compete. But it's not the SEC mandating that it all go onto this auction.
Right. If there are just ways of figuring out some way to either light up these smaller increments for retail or figure out how to better inform the market that there are people who want to trade at these smaller increments.
Because there certainly are plenty of institutional investors that would be more than happy to interact with those orders.
I would even think figuring out a way of making exchange trading more efficient for these tighter spreads.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out a way to get that retail flow onto even an exchange or an ATS, I think would be beneficial for a lot of people.
So let's talk another aspect of reform that's more recent. There's been a lot of discussion about this lately too, on the tiering of the rebate payments, rebate tiers. So, we have not been fans of the rebate system generally, as you know, for a long time, but the tiering and the way the rebates are paid out raises potentially a different set of concerns.
I'm in the process of reading that over pretty carefully now, and I'm thinking about writing something on that. And I wanted to go in thinking, the SEC is on another jihad, this is stupid or whatever. But I'm reading it, and they make a lot of sense. Now, on one hand, where in the world do better customers not get better deals? Walmart buys better than bodega around the corner.
That is right, but one could make too much of that comparison, or as I like to say, NASDAQ is not selling roast chickens, right? It is a very heavily regulated environment. The commission has been regulating exchange fees for decades.
No question. And on the other side of that, you need more than a PhD to understand the pricing structures. I've looked at this multiple times and I cannot figure it out. And
you'd be surprised though, the PhDs can't either. So we get a lot of feedback. So like IEX, we drew a little bit of a rip, but when we started paying a rebate last September, most of the positive feedback we got was from the market making community saying, thank God you're not doing tiers. And I call them and I'd be like, well, I thought you would want tiers because you're the guys who could avail of the tiers. Now, there's a few that are the biggest who really get the tiers, but they were telling us it takes like three scientists staring at these things on an almost daily basis to understand where they are in the month.
We have to explain what we're talking about for people who don't have. Should we have
some?
Good. Yeah.
John, I am so proud of you because usually it's me who goes back.
I know,
back.
Usually it is. So
Larry, we have some non-industry participants. So
I don't know who the hell they are, why they're listening to us, but we love you. Some of them.
And if you would pay for ads, we love you even more.
So just to interject early at this point, if you're trying to figure out what the F we're talking about, so the tier system, most of the large exchanges incentivize people to show up and quote by offering these rebate payments when their orders trade. But the way that the pricing is scheduled, they're heavily skewed to the highest volume firms. So in order to get the best rates, you have to reach volume levels that equal a certain percentage of all of the market trading, which means that the best rates are reserved for relatively few.
Can I give an analogy here, John, if you wouldn't mind?
Please do.
So Larry was saying it as well, but here's a stretch on it slightly, right? So you take Walmart or Costco. Of course, if you go there and you buy 10 pounds of chicken, your price per pound is less than if you buy 1 pound of chicken in a regular supermarket. But what the exchanges want you to do is it's based on all the chicken that's sold in Costco in that given day, right? And it's very hard to calculate.
I was actually thinking about it from the opposite standpoint, that Walmart buys way cheaper than the bodega around the corner.
Yep.
So because they're such massive quantities in so many stores, they get such a huge discount from everybody else. And so I would think of it a little bit more than that, than I can get cheaper things at Walmart than I can at the bodega. But yep. but scale that up, it's the same. It's the same thing.
Yep. Right, right. It's an entirely different
ecosystem. So non-industry insiders, do you know what we're talking about now?
And so what that does is it creates some perverse incentives. First of all, it forces, let's say I am a Virtu or a Citadel, it forces me to put all my flow in the big exchanges so that I hit my tiers. Yep. So it's hard for me to focus, hey, I want to go trade, do all this stuff on IEX tomorrow. If I reallocate all my flow to IEX tomorrow, then I'm not going to hit my tiers on New York and NASDAQ and
that's
and my
meaningful.
Business model. It gets screwed. And second, what that does is also on the other side, if I'm Larry Tabb broker versus Bank of America Merrill Lynch or Goldman Sachs or whoever, Larry Tabb brokerage can't get the same deal that Goldman Sachs can. So the Larry Tabb brokerage is more likely to actually say, hey, Goldman, how would you like to take my flow? And then I can piggyback off of Goldman's rate and I can offer cheaper. So that let's just say I wasn't Goldman, but maybe I was Wells or maybe I was some mid-tier guy, it makes it harder for somebody like that to get the same pricing as a Goldman Sachs does.
And the more that they plow into routing through the Goldman Sachs means that the TCV and the ability to achieve it, it goes even harder. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It's a weird environment where in order to effectively participate in the markets, there is an incentive for you to route orders through your competitor.
Right.
Right. And that's the thing that is on its face seems a bit peculiar about it.
Now, it is economically hard to say, though, that people who buy more shouldn't have a better rate than people who buy less.
No.
You know what I mean? So I can see the other side.
Larger volume firms will continue to have an advantage. You can still get substantially bigger payouts if you can send more orders. But
now the question will be is, let's say I'm one of these marquee exchanges who shall go nameless. Are there other things that I could offer the Virtus and Citadels and folks that make up for all of a sudden? And there probably are.
Right.
So in terms of market data or colo or connectivity or,
well, the exchanges but if you're an exchange, mechanisms. You still have to file for that. You still have to get the SEC to, so it's not like.
But you remember at the market data roundtables that the SEC held?
I was there.
Kincannon was at BATS at the time.
Right.
Or I don't know. Maybe it was CBOE by that time. But he had stated that on any given month, including the colo and the market data that these clients are paying them, there's five clients. Maybe he said six, but I'll just say five. Five that they're still actually remitting payment to. So the rebate that they're paying them is so big, it's higher than their market data fees and everything.
I was
surprised.
I read that in the proposal too. So they quoted that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's in there somewhere.
Now it sounds like I read the proposal.
See, if you'd actually read the proposal, I happen to know that he didn't. I did just read it.
I play that I underprepare, but I read the proposal, I thought that would be something to tell Larry.
Good. Well done. Well done.
But still, that's a shot into all of the, I do business with New York or NASDAQ and they write me a check at the end of the month. Honestly, to a certain extent though, without them writing, is that a bad thing? Is that a bad thing that a Virtu or a Citadel or some large player gets a check at the end of the month? Because they're providing a lot of liquidity. They're providing a service. And theoretically, without them, people would go elsewhere. So they're
not even arguing that it is. I was just saying to your other point, I don't know what else the exchanges can do to compensate them.
Because they're getting money from
– they're already
– In the way that I would think about that, maybe the question is not so much – on its own merits, is it such a bad thing that they are? The question is it a bad thing that everybody else is in effect having to pick up the
subsidizing
and pay and subsidizing that, and where their costs and profit margins are then proportionally reduced because of the fact that they're not.
We talk about it all the time, like our market data rates over the years, it's kind of quelled in the last few years, but it's gone up hundreds of percent. What we're paying for the same fees.
The market data is insane what people pay. If you want like direct feeds from the major exchanges, it could be like $1 million a month or something ridiculous that. It's a lot of money.
We pay millions a year. I will say that. And it's so I would say we're offsetting the credits that they're – but the way of the world, right?
Yeah. I mean, we could be making so much more that I could actually pay propane to heat my house. And
we had an idea once that I don't think it's ever been done. Don't even know if I say it on the podcast, but shouldn't we be allowed to charge the other exchanges what they charge us?
Wow. There you know, there's that. An idea. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Still charge the brokers the same thing, but charge.
Yes, the exchange.
Sorry, my friends at NASDAQ, NYSE, and CBOE.
Oh, so sad.
I'll
we
buy you a pint.
We hate to have to charge you this.
Jeez Louise. Oh, you up my rate 25%? Right back at you, Pat.
Yeah. That's it on the other side. So I don't know where I stand on this. There's some very valid reasons for basically saying that, you know, hey, it's a regulated market. Everybody should have the same access fees. On the other hand, the larger guys, they have multiple ports, they have multiple connectivity, they're buying microwave, they're buying direct feed data.
I think
but
if
on
you
the
take
other hand,
the TCV
you said
out,
the top five guys are getting still getting checks at the end of the month.
Yeah. What do you think about the TCV being removed? Like, let's just say it was a standard rate. If you make 100
TCV
million shares.
TCV stands for total consolidated volume.
Yeah. That
and
means.
That's basically the market wide proportions that you have to trade to get the best rates.
I can't believe you're the one simplifying.
I'm the
things.
One
this
simplifying.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, if you go like, okay, if you're the big guy and you do 100 million shares a day, do you get a better rate than someone with 20 million? I have less of an issue with that. It's just that on any given day, at any given time of the day, you got to calculate if 100 million is enough or you need to do 110 that day or 90 million. That's the part that's
one of the amazing things is they quantified how many pricing tiers these exchanges had. And I want to say that it maxed out at like 97 different tiers for either New York or NASDAQ. I think it was NASDAQ actually. It was some amazingly high number. So how do you figure where in those 97 pricing tiers am I? To make those pricing tiers, if you said maybe the top 10% of your firms wind up at this price, and then maybe or some other way to broaden that, I don't know if
way that it's easily calculated. It doesn't mean that people can't get a volume discount per se.
Yeah.
And that's just the way of the world. Everybody doesn't get the same price.
Talking about this, the SEC, they've been actually kind of quiet lately. I was expecting some of these proposals to come out because if you think about it, not to talk about the T word or the B word, but there's a good chance that politics changes come in the year.
It's looking that way.
I think everybody is assuming that there's going to be a lot of stuff adopted between now and June. But
even then, they don't actually get it into like, turn it on. Could the next commission?
I'm not an expert in the Congressional Review Act, but I think if it's adopted by X date, then you can't undo it based on number of previous days in legislative session. It's a very kind of like Baroque.
I think it's rarely ever happened that a new regime comes in and reverses something, right? That's in the process of implementation.
The market data Chicago? Reforms. It's now 3 effing years, and those market data reforms still
have
not been implemented.
That's true. That was
Clayton's,
wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, yes, but that's not because it was reversed by Congress. It's just that we're still waiting on the computer.
Oh, were you talking about Congress or the new SEC?
No, but I'm talking about the SEC.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Oh, okay.
You know, sorry, Larry, we lost John there.
I don't know, but
he's too busy dumbing it down. He doesn't know what we're talking about.
No, but the MDI went
fuck's
in.
Sake, John.
The market data infrastructure went in at Clayton. Yes, it got sued, but the exchanges finally came up with a pricing scheme. The SEC said, no, we don't like your pricing scheme, but gave them no feedback on how to fix it.
But when Clayton put it in, though, was it adopted in a set date for implementation set? I don't think so.
A time frame that was set, but the problem is that I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but the time frame all depended upon the exchanges getting together and proposing a pricing
structure.
Yeah, but
they did that like 2 years
ago. I know, that's true.
Yeah, but to Larry's point, like these Reg NMS things that we were talking about earlier were proposed in December 22. You'd imagine
whether people sue them or not, adopt one. But for a major initiative, a year between proposal and adoption is not that unusual at all.
Former regulator always defends them.
Yeah,
John
I am not defending them. I'm just saying that I think that it's appropriate.
But it seems like the SEC has gone out of their way to drag their feet to implement the MDI stuff. And the MDI stuff was really heralded by pretty much everybody in the industry as an okay thing.
Yeah, but not the exchanges. But because they sued. But they lost.
Where are we with that anyway? If they lost.
Well, I don't know. We could talk about that, but let's pivot.
Okay.
Now, and talk about another interesting
We're going to talk
trend.
About whatever John wants to talk about.
No.
Do you all pivot to something you want to talk
no,
about?
No, I'm pivoting want. Back to you to reverse pivot your pivot. Okay. What do you want to talk about?
So let's talk about sub-dollar trading. So we just
I just talked with the FT about that today.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
No, and we wrote something about that a couple months
well,
ago.
Well, interesting.
That is a
thought.
Huge scam.
So just so, well, that's kind of what we think too.
Bingo.
So people understand what we're talking about. Most exchanges have listing rules that sort of say that you're supposed to maintain a typically $1 a share minimum rate, but there are an increasing number of issuers that are trading at less than $1 a share. Most of them typically on NASDAQ, because NASDAQ, to be fair, like seeks and attracts more kind of low cap issuers. But there are a lot more of these people. So you have like a really significant chunk of the total market volume that is
sub-penny.
Composed of firms that are right. trading at very, very low. Right. So talk about that.
Yeah. No, we've been seeing this and we looked at the economics of it. So you think about the economics when the economics are, you know, for a regular NMS stock above a buck, there's an access fee of 30 cents per 100 shares. For the sub-dollar stocks, it's 30 mils on the value.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually multiply that out, and there are no rebates for these sub-dollar stocks, so the economics for trading these sub-dollar stocks is actually better than the economics for trading higher value stocks. And so there's not a whole lot of incentive for the exchanges to delist these
right.
because they actually make a lot of money on it. So that's one thing. The second is you see these reverse splits for these low-priced stocks. And so there's the companies try to get around these $1 things by doing these reverse splits to get their stock price back above a dollar. But
yes.
given their companies are kind of flaky, they wind up coming back under a dollar and then they reverse split again.
Right.
Well, they do. Like it was one reverse split
yeah,
recently,
well,
right?
So
like,
there was one of these issuers that we noticed that had recently-
How does a 1,000-for-1- come off as legitimate at all? Like if the fact that you have to reverse split 1,000-for-1 means you're a bleep bleep stock, right?
Yeah.
That's dog
much.
Shit in
and
bleep
then,
language.
And then the other thing is
we're
that?
Not casting aspersions on any particular issuer. We're going to have to scrub this with legal now because Ronan's
no,
like right
I didn't
in his
say
mouth
the symbol.
About it.
Okay.
Then there's this other thing right. that's going on is that
you bet
reverse,
I didn't.
That these reverse splits are done very quickly.
Uh-huh.
So they're right. announced and implemented like a day or two later.
Yeah.
And the problem with corporate actions, a split as a corporate action or a reverse split as a corporate action, is that there's no single place to register these corporate actions where you can get the whole group of them. So you're left, depending upon where it's registered, it could fall off the radar list. And folks may think that this stock is still trading at a penny when really it's trading at a buck. And there's this whole Reddit thing going on of retail folks
yep.
trying to
yep.
play against to try to get these dollar stocks for a penny. And so if they can actually make that happen,
why
the
they're
broker,
saying they should?
The, no,
because
no.
Because they didn't know?
Well, the brokers yeah. should and exchanges and they should, but sometimes yeah. they don't
okay.
because they don't follow it. So that you've got this group of people trying to sell the $10 stock or the penny stock at $10 or buy the $10 stock at
oh,
a penny.
I didn't realize that.
And what happens when that occurs is the brokerages actually take it on the chin. They eat that.
Really?
Yeah, you know, because it's their mistake. They didn't get the corporate action right. And so
how long were corporate actions – or how long are they normally – like a typical corporate action – because
you
bring
if you
up
announce
a good point,
a dividend,
couple of days seems nuts.
If you announce a dividend, usually that's – a month, you know, certainly a couple of weeks.
Yeah. These are announced, I have noticed that also, very
quickly.
Soon.
Well, why
quickly
didn't you say that in your thought piece on it?
Well, you know, because I can't think of everything, okay? I think it was thoughtful.
Thank you, Larry.
What I did say was thoughtful.
I'm going to okay. give Larry credit.
All right. Okay,
and so what
quiet.
Happens is yep. the broker eats this, and then a lot of times the market maker will make good for that. So it winds up basically getting picked up by the Virtues and Citadels. But
yep.
basically, the industry eats that and the retail investor gets away with it.
And speaking of kind of weird incentives, and I did mention this in my thoughtful piece, Ronan, but bringing it back to rebate tiers, a lot of things people don't appreciate because I just discovered it, is that the way these volume tiers are set, and this is pretty much true with all the big exchanges, is that a share of Apple counts as much as one of these penny stocks. So there's this natural built-in incentive for people maybe to trade more in stocks that they wouldn't if they're really concerned about hitting the tiers, which means that it's another strange incentive that exists.
Well, a lot of these, what we did was we looked at the OTC on exchange volume for a lot of these low price stocks. And actually, most of them are traded over the counter.
Right, right. But you may have more of them. They may be traded more on exchange than they would otherwise in circumstances where if you can get some benefit from it, right?
Certainly, certainly. So the whole thing is kind of screwed up. And even if they just had a centralized place to list these things or force these firms to at least take a week to do this reverse split, I think you'd wind up with a lot less of this.
But beyond that, do you think that it's time to kind of like take another look at exchange listing standards?
Absolutely.
Or kind of like how quickly stuff can actually be jettisoned if it seems that it's unlikely?
Yeah, they should at least be enforced. Yeah.
If they're a legitimate company and they're going through some challenges, the question is, do you want to kick them off tomorrow if their stock goes below a buck? Yeah. Probably not.
But we're talking about
But weeks or months or whatever. Yeah.
The rules typically often allow these things to stay on for a year or longer, right? When that seems a little strange.
Yeah. I think it would be good for them to either get this reverse split done either, quickly, but with certainly an announcement period and good notice.
And maybe firms with market caps of less than $10 million. Like, this is as insane as we're talking. They just shouldn't be publicly listed.
This used to be like, what happened in the OTC and the pink sheet markets. And apparently those guys have cleaned up their acts so that it's not happening there.
Really?
It's actually happening in the NMS stocks.
Which is the exact opposite of what you would expect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to do another pivot before we go to the fun questions?
Yes, you want me to pivot?
T+1.
Yes.
Is that what you're going to do?
I
could read it.
I mean, yes. It's a rather mundane topic. I don't get excited about
May
it, but 24. It is important. So one big change on the horizon is U.S. markets are going to move to T+1, trade plus one. Settlement has to be done the next day. For a while, people were saying, we're not going to be ready for that. It's going to create all kinds of chaos. What are your thoughts? Do you think people are ready? Is it going to create pressure for Europe to follow suit?
Well, I'm an old dude. I've been through this before. I was very involved with this in 1999, 2000, when we tried to do it before. That said, I think it's going to be incredibly expensive, actually. So we're actually starting to write about this now, and we're going to try to do an estimate of what we think the cost is to the industry of moving to T+1. And the problem isn't U.S. equities, U.S. investors trading U.S. equities. Well, actually, some of that there. So there are four or five real challenges in moving to T+1. The first is the buy side does these block trades, and they reallocate them. So basically, I got 100,000 shares. I split it up between a couple of brokers. They put it in algos, and that 100,000 shares could be done in 10,000 trades or 1,000 trades. And to be fair to the investors, they wind up reaggregating them, creating average prices, and everybody within the fund gets the same price. Because otherwise, let's just say I push the price up, the guys who were in early get a better price than the guys who get allocated later. So under the new rules, that those allocations and confirmations need to be done by 9 o'clock. DTCC or put out a piece just the other day saying that only like 67 or 65% of the trades actually get fully allocated by 9 o'clock at night, which means the other third of institutional trades would basically fail. And so what that would mean is that somebody has to carry the cost of that money. They have to basically borrow money, or they're not going to receive shares or whatever for a day until that gets resolved, which has a price, especially if interest rates are 5.25%. That's one issue.
Does that issue alone not potentially delay this? That's a pretty big issue.
I don't think
issue.
It delays it, but it's gonna cost people money. The second issue is short covering. So your Fidelity, your cap group, whatever, you've got a lot of stock sitting at some custodian, and you lend it out, and that gives you some basis point return. PM decides to sell it. You've got to get that stock back from people who have borrowed it. That can take a day or two. They won't have a whole lot of time to get that stock back. So the question is, how do you speed that process up? And especially with Equilend getting hacked and the whole short, the whole securities lending industry is right now a mess because of that. But how do I get that back? And if I don't get that back, that means that I'm going to fail on them, or I've got to give them a heads up that I got to sell this, not now, but tomorrow. And so I'm leaking information because I got to tell these guys before I actually sell the security. So that's another problem. And then foreign exchange. So if I'm an Asian, and this happens more with Asian investors, if I'm in Asia and I'm buying or selling stock, the markets aren't open at the same time. So how do I get the money moved? Because money movements are 2 days and securities movements will be 1 day. And what will happen is the banks will basically have to, they'll have to borrow money from the banks borrow securities. So there's going to be a lot of borrowing going on to ensure settlements.
It obviously would be, some of those issues would be worked out if other people just follow suit and do what we've done. But, you know, you can't mandate that.
What about when we went from T3 to T2? Were any of these issues around?
No, not as many, because you still had a day.
Short interest was still less, but time.
I don't know if short interest, actually short interest was probably more because that was before Reg SHO.
Oh, sorry, I meant covering the shorts. If capital, it was 1 day less, but it was.
Yeah. But they could still speed things up. Now they actually have to re-engineer the process.
Okay.
And so it becomes much more challenging.
Yeah, I thought I saw something today on the by 9 p.m., and I thought they had changed. It was on Bloomberg.
Yeah.
Was that 60-something percent, or I thought it had gone higher.
No, the goal is to get it to 90.
Okay. Maybe it was
and
that
DTCC
they said the goal.
Put out that it's 60-something percent. So I want to say 65, 67, something like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, now we're going to pivot.
We're going to pivot. We're going to take it down
to fun
a bit.
Things, because we got to wrap this up fairly soon.
Yes.
All right. We're going to have you back, man. This is good stuff. Mm-hmm. But fun fact we heard about yourself is that you are a furniture building in your spare time.
Yes, oddly enough, we were talking about this beforehand. Oddly Ronan enough, also likes to work with his hands.
Believe it or not, I don't have all the tools at home, so I go to my kids' high school and they allow me to use all the equipment there. So I have industrial grade stuff, but I'm not
as
talented.
So when you chop off your finger, you'll have somebody to sew.
I do got to tell you, the guy last night was telling me, got to focus a little more on the table saw. I'm like 2 plus 1.
That's one of the reasons why I like working with wood.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, you actually have something when you're done.
Yeah, it's a tangible asset.
It's a tangible asset other than writing stuff. Second, it does make you focus, and you know, you really shouldn't be thinking about T+1 when you're working with a table saw.
Yeah. I promise. I'm exact. But I do get in
sure
a bit of
Zen. Sure, he's not.
I go there and I just chisel away.
It is very Zen.
It really is. What are you currently working on?
Not working on anything now. I just finished up.
Show me a cool picture.
I just finished up an end table. So I had built a sofa table that had curved legs. It's hard to explain, but they kind of curve in and they're weird. My brother gave me some walnut because he does some wood and he lives in upstate New York, and somebody gave him some walnuts. I figured, okay, what am I going to do with this walnut he gave me? And so I figured, I'll make a little coffee table. And my wife said, oh, I like those curved legs on the sofa table. What can you do? And I was like, how do you put curve? You know, the table's only 18 by 18 or 16 by 16. How do you curve them? All the legs will hit each other. Yeah. So I put one leg on each side. And I was worried that the thing wouldn't even stand because I've never seen that done before.
It came out cool.
It came out cool.
Yeah, I like the look of it.
It's a combination.
Might be my next project.
It could be your next project.
Larry Tab
Table. Why don't you bring something in?
LTT.
Every once in a while and show us the result of your
handiwork. I will. I've showed you pictures. Very good.
Yeah, but I've made beds for the kids. I've made wall, you know, bookshelves.
Tangible assets. This ain't crypto. Tangible assets.
Great.
See, that's
cherry table for our kitchen.
What I did just there.
I've done a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I saw that. That was very clever.
Thank you.
And so should we segue now
to our last question, the fun question. So I hope you got prepped on this one, because we used to ask everybody their favorite Wall Street movie and why.
Yeah.
And we pivoted all
places.
There you go. Well, it is the best answer, actually.
Exactly.
I love that movie. Yeah. But our fun question now is, if the Wall Street Bull came to life and could talk, what words of wisdom or advice do you think it would share?
Oh, do your homework. You know, this whole idea of getting...
I thought you were about to go, oh, fuck, you never gave me that question.
Which would be appropriate,
Do your homework.
You know, this whole idea, you know, it's really nice to go on Reddit or go get these tip sheets and say, oh, I think that, you know, Larry Tab stock is really hot today. You're going to buy it. It's going to pop and you're going to make a bazillion dollars. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to just go buy Larry Tab stock. And it's like, if you're not going to put in the time, just go buy a broad-based ETF and just let it ride. Let the market work for you. Trading is really, really hard. People spend a lot of time understanding charts, understanding stocks, doing the investment research, figuring out what the right entry and exit points are. And if you don't really want to do that, let the market work for you. Yep. Buy a broad-based ETF. Go buy like a blue chip. Go buy Apple or go buy something that's going
to
be there tomorrow.
It's not a safe place to half-ass it.
It is not a safe place to have assets.
And of course, the bull would also say, trade more through IEX.
Probably.
Yes. Yeah, probably so. Yeah.
If we programmed it correctly. Well, Larry, thanks very much for being our guest today. We appreciate it. We could talk on forever, but we're told that we need to keep these podcasts short for the millennials.
Well, then we've already screwed that up, but we have covered a lot of good material.
Maybe we'll have Larry back and cover like one topic at a time.
Okay. All right.
The LTT, Larry Tab Table or Larry Tab Topic?
Always happy to do this, guys. It's a lot of fun. And again, I have to hand it to you. These things are not easy to manage, and you've done a really great job.
We drink a lot before each and every one of them.
Not this time, but I swear we have it. Thank you, right. Larry.
Thank you. Over and out. Boxes and Lions.
Yes.
Cheers.
Goodbye.
Are you a diehard boxer or liner, or just a fair weather fan? No judgments, I know how annoying JR's Irish accent can be. Either way, we want to hear from you on our new Boxes and Lines listener survey to find out what you think about the show, give input on future episodes, guests, and more. We'll take it back to our survey counter thingy machine and consider all of your inputs as we plan our 2024 season. You can find the survey at iex.getfeedback.com/boxesandlines, and don't worry, there's something in it for you. That's my drum roll. JR could probably do it better. You get a pair of socks. That's right. Take the survey. We'll send you a pair of our coveted Box and Line socks while supplies last in a new limited edition print. How's that for listener appreciation? So take the survey, tell us what you think, and thanks for listening. Again, that's iex.getfeedback.com/boxesandlines. Over and out.
Boxes and Lines is a podcast from IEX Exchange. It is hosted by Ronan Ryan and John Ramsey. Executive produced by Daisy Clace, with support from Benstown. For more information and to hear more episodes, go to iexexchange.io/podcast. Thank you for listening to Boxes and Lines. The information and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational and educational purposes only, and IEX Group Incorporated and its affiliates do not make any representations or warranties as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Nothing in this podcast constitutes a solicitation or offer to buy or sell any securities or provide any investment advice or service. Some portions of the preceding conversation may have been edited for length or clarity. Copyright IEX Group Incorporated, all rights reserved.